Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is episode 4 of Your Story. I've had a very interesting week. Last Tuesday, on the 4th of December, I decided that I would actually officially launch this podcast of mine. I've had a few episodes up for quite a few weeks, but I decided that I'd actually have a proper official launch day. I just thought, it's a good day to actually get out there and tell everybody. So I bounced out a few emails, I climbed onto Twitter and mentioned it, and I jumped onto Facebook and let everybody in my Facebook list know that this is what I've been up to for the last many months and why I've basically gone to ground. And while I've been doing it, I've got so deep into this process of doing it that many times I've actually forgotten, you know what it's like. You're so close to it, you don't know what it's really like. And you have to sort of step back from it to have a bit of a decent appreciation of it. And you can only really get that with time. So it's been great that there have been a few people out there that have got back to me and thanked me and thought, you know, what I was doing was pretty good. And the encouragement's been, frankly, gratifying. I truly, truly appreciate it, everybody. Thank you. It's middle of December. Christmas is but a couple of weeks away. And I'm sure you're all out there shopping away, spending your money, doing what we do at this time of year. And I wonder how many people are out there buying books. Now, you can all go to the Borders and Amazon and the huge organisations to go and buy your books. But if you look around, in every one of your communities, there's one of those little booksellers, isn't there? They're up there on the high street. You know, they're selling the slightly more quirky little books. You know, sometimes they're secondhand bookstores, sometimes they're new. And they've got people in them who are absolutely passionate about books and reading and writing and all that sort of thing. You know, dusty, musty, filled bookstores with quirky things. Very different to the big chains. And frankly, I wonder how they're going to go in the long term. Well, I've got one of those bookstores here in my local community. It's called The Avid Reader. It's a very cool little bookstore, and it's, you know, it's exactly as I described it. As a matter of fact, they moved into, I think it's an old Commonwealth Bank building, and they chopped up the strong room in order to put in a coffee shop. You know, sort of these 1.5 foot thick concrete reinforced walls, on display for everybody to see. Well, at the Avid Reader, there's a lady there, Chrissy Keane. She's been working there for quite some time. I've known her for a few years, just off and on, you know, sort of casual acquaintance, you know. And I thought she'd be interesting. So I said, hey, Chrissy, you know, I've got this podcast thing that I've got sort of bubbling away in the background. Do you want to come and sit and talk to me and tell me what you're on about? And that's what today's story's about. Now, Chrissy's a writer, and as well as working in the bookstore, you know, like most writers, like myself, doing this, you know, you've got to have a real job, haven't you? And she's a writer, and we discuss the challenges of being a writer, you know, a little bit about the discipline. We talk about her passion for writing and the creative process, and we talk about her background, her life, and the thing that I found interesting about Chrissy is she's self-published a little book, which we discuss, and she has a rather unusual way, a different spin on the way she sees the world to the way most people would probably look at it. And she's written this rather lovely little book of short stories, of erotic short stories. However, they're a little bit different to the normal book in that all the characters within the book have some form of disability or something odd about them. And she continues to look at them as being sexual beings, which in our society, frankly, we often forget to do. It's an interesting way of seeing different things in life. Welcome. This is Chrissy.
Hello, Chrissy.
Hello.
Chrissy, this is my little podcast called Your Story. And what I'm doing is I'm actually going around talking to people and getting their story. So I want to know your story, and we'll get to this little thing here shortly. Mm-hmm. So what's your story?
My story is that I'm a writer. And I think that's the central thing in my life and always has been. So that's the thing that drives me and that I'm constantly searching for.
What's a writer? In your world, what is a writer?
Well, a writer basically is someone who just writes and who's actually, that is what drives them, is the drive to actually create fiction in my case. In other people's case, it's different. It's a different thing. But for me, it's about chasing the perfect, beautiful piece of writing. That's what my life is about. I really believe in beauty. I think I don't have any kind of religious leanings or any spiritual leanings of any sort. And the closest thing I have to a spirituality is a desire for beauty, and that's in art. I lean towards anything beautiful in any kind of art form, but because writing is my passion, I'm really looking for that perfect, beautiful piece of writing.
So what's the take home for you when you know, like, is it the process of writing, or is it the finishing the writing, or is it reading the writing?
It's knowing I've written, I think, is the thing. I am much happier when I've written something. Like, I lean towards existential angst, I suppose, and I don't think there is any meaning in life. I don't really believe that there is meaning. And I think that life is about distracting yourself from the fact that there is no meaning. So finding a distraction from that.
Because is writing your distraction?
The chase of the perfect piece of writing is my distraction. It's the thing that gives me a point and gives me a meaning in life.
So if you couldn't write, mm-hmm. would you live in that existential angst permanently, and that would be turmoil for you?
If I couldn't create art, I think if I couldn't write, if there was a reason... I've got a friend who's had a severe stroke recently, and he wouldn't be able to write if that was his thing. He wouldn't be able to do that at the moment because language and words are a real problem for him. And I look at him and I think, you know, if I was him, I would be turning to sculpture, or I'd be turning to, well, not sculpture because his hands are not so good, but I'd be turning to art in some way. I'd be turning to painting, probably.
Yeah, something that's relatively easy, like painting.
Yeah, something too, and I'd be striving for exactly the same thing, for that perfection of the creative process.
Have you always written? Were you one of these people who, you know, as soon as you can make letters on a bit of paper, you were writing stories?
Yeah, I did. I've got a lot of kids' books that I wrote when I was a kid, so with just, you know, a couple of letters at a time and a little picture up top. But I really didn't become passionate about that until probably I was about grade six at school, and that became everything. And in a way, it's an escape. For me, it's always been an escape to write because... It's the world that you have some kind of control over. It is inventing a perfect space to be, where I don't actually think that the world is a perfect space for me. I don't feel comfortable in the world, and so I'm comfortable in the world that I create.
So it is a fantasy. You go to this fantasy place when you're right.
Yeah, it is. It is a fantasy place, and it's something that I have control over. But as I've made it more a career, and more something that I'm striving for as a career, it becomes less of that pure joy that I had when I was a child to be able to escape the real world and become part of. You know, I used to have my friends were the people that I wrote about, and so when I was in the real world, I was distracted from being with my friends. But nowadays it's not like that for me. Now I have a lot more of an eye for craft, and I have a lot more control over the process. So it is more work now than play. But
do you still enjoy it?
I do enjoy it. There are moments when I don't enjoy it. I enjoy having done it well.
Writer's angst, the normal, you know, writer's block, all those problems that writers all
have. It's hard work. I think it really is hard work, and sometimes it doesn't come out well.
Well, you know, for anybody who may be listening, we're sitting in a room, what, about 3 metres by 5 metres with a desk, and it's a nice space, nice bright walls, but You know, it's just a little box, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's not a you know, beautiful... Writing is not a beautiful process.
Well, you're not overlooking a beautiful vista, are you?
No.
It's a bright blue wall. It's interesting colour, but it's certainly not...
Yeah, that's right. And being distracted from writing by a beautiful vista.
So are you disciplined when you write? I've heard a lot of writers have to be. You know, they go, right, for 8 hours, you know, with two breaks, I'm going to... And they plod away and they diligently flog themselves until they get the books written.
Yeah.
Some of them write huge numbers of books that way, I've heard.
Yeah, yeah. I spend... the kind of writing that I do is not something that you can write. It's not the sort of thing that you can just plot and then fill in. So it's not like a... it's not a plot-driven piece. So it's not popular fiction. It's more literary fiction, which in a way is a more difficult process. I think, you know, people who write a thriller, you can plot it out and then you can really quickly, you know, paint by numbers, fill it in, and it's done, and you can churn through books that way. For me, there's a lot more kind of, you know, pain and struggle with it because there isn't a set formula for doing literary fiction. But I do have very intense periods where I'll go away for 2 weeks at a time and I'll do nothing but write and sleep very little and spend that whole time with the concentration of that book in my head. And that's normally when I make a big run on it. I can go away and write. I've written 40,000 words in 2 weeks,
right,
from scratch doing that. And they've been reasonably okay. I've come back and gone, oh, you know, that's actually...
Do you ever get into one of those beautiful blissed out states when you're doing that? Do you just find, you know, the marathon runners, you know, bliss, you know, they could go forever?
I do get those moments where you feel like you've broken through and you're actually just clean writing, and that's a very beautiful space to be in when you're clean writing, but even that isn't sustainable for that time.
Did you write a word processor or a longhand?
Oh, no, I longhand write first and then I type in. So normally in those big concentrated periods, I write in the morning from very, very early. And then when I run out of steam, I just turn to the computer and type what I've got, which is like doing a second draft really of that work.
Yeah.
And then I go back to writing the draft longhand. It's really annoying though, because typing in is boring. And I don't like it.
Mm.
But you do make a lot of changes as you go, and it's actually a good process of editing.
Yeah.
So it is, for me, it's the best way to do it.
Are you a good typist?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I make a lot of mistakes, but, you know, your computer tells you.
Yeah, but that's where I can be great, just be able to sit there and just rattle out.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen typists who don't even, you know, they're just amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I'm a touch typist and I'm quick.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Which is good.
I envy you for that.
Yeah, it's a good thing. But, yeah.
So what sort of books do you write? Now, I've got this one here. We'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah.
Because that's... You know, an interesting little puppy.
Yeah. Probably challenging would be the words that most people use when they've looked at my stuff. It's I always...
Is it always this style?
No. I always take the position of the outsider. My position in the world is of the outsider, and very clearly, my characters are outsiders. Normally.
So your character is always the people who are on the fringes of society, the misfits, the people who do things in different ways.
Yeah, that's right. The people who don't fit into the mainstream. And it's interesting.
So accountants don't feature heavily in your...
No, for some reason they
unless,
don't.
Of course, they drink. They dress
don't.
Up in stilettos
that's
and
right.
go to work and
that's
they're
male. Right. Yes. No, my partner is... Or he writes for film a lot too, and his writing is always takes exactly the opposite position to me. So we're always arguing over if we work together, because we've worked together on a number of projects. My view is always to take the outsider's perspective, and his view is always to find the insider and to have the insider exposed to the unusual circumstance. And mine is to have the outsider trying to break into the normal world, or the outsider who the normal world infringes on their life. And so we have these complete opposite positions.
I'd love to see you two write two different parts for a movie and put them in conflict with each other. I think that'd be a corker.
We write for film together, and it's always a bit of a struggle.
We always
have to make compromises, but they're good once we
it'd be the misfit trying to fit in with society and the way that doesn't or does work.
Yeah,
I think it'd be brilliant.
It's a good relationship, because my my work is often people find it hard to find that place in because they don't want to be in that position of the outsider. A lot of people say it makes them uncomfortable.
Sure, so, sure. I can, you know, reading that little book, you know, so a couple of little things and that's to go, oh, I never thought about the world that way.
Yeah.
So what sort of person, what sort of, have you always done that? Ever since you were a little thing, have you always gone for the, you know, the weird, the esoteric?
I'm from an outsider family, and so we positioned ourselves as a family. So I grew up within a family that was a very outsider family. They didn't, my grandmother, who I was raised with, is a migrant, and didn't have a community as such, didn't socialise with neighbours. Even when she lived in the city, she didn't kind of have a network and would prefer, grew very large trees and hedges so that no one could see in.
Barricade
it was all
yourself.
Very much barricaded, very much didn't have anything to do with the world. Well, she doesn't like to put it out there. She's Eastern European and she doesn't like to talk about.
I know some lovely Eastern European people.
Yes, but she's got an odd little take on the world. Yeah. And now she's moved even further out to the country where she absolutely cannot have contact with the outside world.
So really?
Very, very insular.
Has any of this rubbed off on you?
Yeah, absolutely. I do feel... I don't feel like I completely fit in. I don't feel like I have a...
You're working in one of the coolest bookstores in Brisbane.
You like to think so. I do.
You know, like you're working retail. You've got people coming up to you every day.
And
you,
I know
you sound like
a lot
somebody
of people.
Who should be locked in a safe somewhere, riding away.
Yeah, I'm very tempted to... I tend towards the isolation thing, but I don't have very good... I don't have close friends.
Okay.
I have a lot of people that I know and that I'm familiar with, and I have a lot of people that I'm friendly with, but I don't have close.
Yeah.
I don't have close friends, and that's because of that that upbringing. That outside.
So, did your grandmother raise you? Did she?
My grandmother and my mother and my aunt together.
Right.
So it was a family that didn't kind of.
So you basically you lived in communities, of course, you'd have, unless you lived as hermits. But are you saying that you basically lived by yourselves?
Yeah.
You didn't mix with the society that was around you.
No, and I wasn't. I wasn't allowed to have friends outside of the house either. So
did you have to stay just within the family or just within your social community?
No, just in the family.
Wow.
I went to school, but I wasn't allowed to
have
go to friends.
Sleepovers.
No time away from home. People could come and visit our house because then we were heavily supervised, but I wasn't allowed out to people's houses. So I didn't have that kind of...
So how do you think that's affected the way you see the world?
It means I'm a little bit distrusting, I think, of
that's right, you can trust
people.
Me. I don't
die. I don't distrust people on a day-to-day general basis, but I think a deep and honest friendship and trust takes a very, very long time, and it's incredibly rare.
Yeah.
So I make friends rarely.
Do you have a couple of people in your life who are very, very close to you? They are, you know, part of you?
Yeah, I do. I've probably had three people in my life who are very close over the years and who I still have that kind of sense of they will be family almost, even though, you know, a couple of them I don't see anymore.
Yeah, it's a concept I keep bouncing around. I've written a little bit about it on my little blog attached to this, and I know it's a theme that's going to keep coming up in these podcasts, is a concept I call the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
It's you have your community,
mm-hmm.
and then you have your family. And sometimes your family members, but often not, can be involved in it. But then there's your tribe.
Mm.
And your tribe are those people that you would walk over hot coals for. You know, they are the core essence of who you are.
Yeah.
Often what people would call family. But they're closer than family.
Mm.
Unless, you know, there's some lucky members of your family that you allow to be in your tribe.
Yeah.
Sounds like these few people are your tribe.
Yeah.
Using my terms.
Yeah, they are. That's right. And it is rare. And I know it when I've... You know, very, very rarely do I meet someone who I know that person is going to be someone that I connect with. And when I do, it's an odd experience because they become quite quickly very, very...
Do you know it straight away when you first meet them?
Pretty much, yeah. I'm very, very quickly anyway.
Wow. That's interesting, isn't
it? But it's only been, you know, a few times in my life.
Sure.
But each of those times it's like you recognise yourself.
I don't think you're that, you know, three or so times in your life. I think people at that level within your life, I don't think people would have dozens of them. Mm. I think people would only ever have a handful. Maybe a few people would have two handfuls.
Mm.
But I don't think it's that many. I don't think you've got that much energy to put that many people in your life, frankly.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Because it takes a lot of energy to be emotionally connected to those sort of people. So you've written this book of esoteric novels, which I had... erotic, yes. No, it starts with E.
Yeah,
erotic stories. I had to read it. You know, this is self-published, isn't it?
It's a little publishing. The reason it got published in the first place is because Christopher, who works with me here, and I, we both write, and we have started a little publishing company.
Which is called
eBooks. And we've been talking about doing this for ages because we see that the main publishers are not publishing the kind of fiction we love. Literary fiction is very hard to sell.
Now, before you go on, I'd like you to clear something up for me. Like, I'm not a huge jobber. I am a pretty big reader these days, but I'm always a big non-fiction reader. I'm just not into fiction. But I only came to reading late in life. You know, I'm talking about 25.
Yep.
What is literature? Literature. You know, what is what is... You're talking about the better quality of writing, aren't you? You're not talking about pulp.
No.
What is literature?
It's really hard to... It's very hard to pin it down exactly, but it is where the quality of the words and the way the words are put together and the way the ideas are put together is equally as important as the structure of the book and the characters and the plot. They're normally driven by the quality of the writing.
The quality of the writing, the way the grammar, the way it's all composed, the structure of the writing.
The poetics of it, yeah.
Sure,
almost.
Great word. That's equally as important as the message that's there.
Or not even a message as the plot or whatever. They don't. It's when you read it, it's something that people have had trouble defining.
Why I asked you.
Yeah, it's quite. but they can say it's like these writers. You know, you could say the word Michael Ondaatje, who wrote The English Patient, and you can go, well, that is definitely literary fiction. And you read that, and it's the rhythm of the words and the poetics and the ideas and the style all add up to something. And some of his books are completely plotless. You know, you kind of struggle to find the plot, but you read it and it ignites sparks of ideas in you because he sees the world in a really different way.
And seeing and having that quality is, you're almost saying, more important than the actual story.
It is for him.
Sounds counterintuitive to me.
It does, and that's why it doesn't sell, I suppose.
And by the way, I thought English Patient was a dirge of a film.
Well, the film's not very good, I don't think. But the book is
amazing. Well, no, I know a lot of people love the movie, just adored it, and I thought it was a dirge.
I didn't like the film, but I love
But I don't
book.
Think I would like the book either.
No, you might not like the book, but that has more of a plot than his other books. His other books are a lot harder than that one. But it's something, you know, we're a little bit lazy with our reading these days. We like it to be simple, we like it to be easy. We read a lot of magazines, so magazines are designed so you can read them quickly.
Yeah.
A
lot of writing is very conversational.
But
that's not what you're talking about.
No. I actually think that what I love about books and what's disappearing from fiction these days is that you are drawn into a particular style that where the whole mood, the whole way the words are put together is part of the whole style. It's like the mise-en-scene. It's the setting, you know, that you come into, and that's part of the quality of the words. And that's beginning to fall away from fiction because people don't read it because people are a bit lazy and they want something that's a good holiday read.
So do you think...
Not challenging.
Where do you see this as being a problem?
It's a problem for the readers that do care about words. Because that sort of writing can be film. That sort of writing can be magazine or radio.
Sure. There's a lot of people who are writing blogs nowadays. But no experience. I hold my hand up. And as time goes by, the people who are passionate about this literature, like you, will fade away, drop off the... but they'll have to be re-educated looking back on old stuff or any new stuff that's written, but it'll become less and less popular.
Yep.
Where do you see is the problem in that? Well, isn't that just the natural evolvement, like wheelwrights don't exist anymore?
That's, yes, but there, you know, what has happened with crafts, with the crafts, is that those crafts that don't exist anymore are still around, but they've become art. You know, like they used to be functional, and now it's something that is now it's something that's held as being special, and people do see the beauty in, you know, hand throwing a pot rather than having. So it's moved to a different place where it's not your mainstream.
So literature will move into an art form, whereas once upon a time it was utilitarian.
Yep. That's right.
And utilitarian writing will be what we're all currently used to on the net and in magazines, newspapers, conversational. Okay.
And that's a different. It's a different form. It's not something that. It's not something that I want to engage in. I know that I could easily write, that kind of style stuff and probably sell more books and probably get published more easily. But that's not. That is not. The search for the perfect thing.
No, well, you're speaking like a classic artist.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's exactly like that. It's like making that piece of artwork that might take 20 years to make, but that's the thing that you're striving for. And, you know, both Chris and I are striving for that. And so when I sort of met Chris and went, oh, look, he's striving for the same thing. We work in the same place. We might as well use this connection to create a publishing company that is going to do that. And so my little book of erotica was almost an experiment in publishing so that we could learn the steps that we need that we didn't know. So the actual putting together of a book, the printing of it, the design that we understand as booksellers but that we hadn't had a chance to experiment with, and more importantly, I suppose, the sales and marketing, which is something that we have, little experience in, and so that was something that we needed to learn. And so this has been an experiment, but it's actually been a successful experiment. So it's been a nice
handy that you work here at the Avid Reader, because this is a hub to quite a large network out there of similar stores. And how have you gone getting it out?
Oh, it's great. It's gone into Melbourne and Sydney and Western Australia. There's a shop in Western Australia that's got as well.
So just a couple of bookstores in a couple of places?
Just a few. It's probably in about 30 bookstores in total.
Okay.
Which is, it's good. That's good.
Yeah, that's fine. You're aiming for a particular class type of bookstore.
Yeah.
So you're not in the, are you in Amazon?
No. And Amazon's always been something that booksellers have struggled with because it's not, it's... Amazon is... They don't pay GST. We can't compete with Amazon.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a whole different conversation.
It's a whole different...
And maybe I might get Fiona. I've actually thought about getting Fiona on this.
Yeah, she'd know more.
That's your boss, you know, and having a long yarn to her about, the demise of the... suburban bookstore to the online providers.
We provide something very different, I suppose. So that's
So
that's where our books are aimed.
So let's talk about Swallow the Sound. This is how many pages? It's a tiny little book. It's hardly a tome, is it?
We tried to keep it tiny, and we probably kept it too tiny.
Three stories in 37 pages.
That's right. And it actually could easily be... it actually could have been a bigger product. And this is one of the things that I've learned, because the other things that are out there in the market probably would use the same amount of words and make it double the size.
I remember years ago coming across Michael Jackson's biography. And the amount of white space and empty pages in that book was amazing. You could have condensed it down to probably a 60-page book, but it was 200 or 300 pages. It was extraordinary.
And the idea behind this was to try and keep it small. So it's quite small font and very fine paper.
Yes, it is.
And the reason for doing that was to try and... Well, it was kind of the idea that... You know that underwear becomes more desirable the smaller it is. So that it was almost like that, and I think I probably underdid it. And when we do the next in the series, we're going to bulk that out a little bit more.
Yeah,
so sure. That it's a bit more of a substantial.
But I love the quality of the finish that you put on it.
Yeah, that's beautiful satin. Finish.
And you know, I was looking at there's a naked chick on the front of it,
mm-hmm.
but I've seen her before. But then when I turned it up the other way, she made a lot more sense when she's. The book's upside down. I suddenly saw her properly. I went, "Oh, hello, baby."
Yeah, it's a beautiful, it's a very striking image.
Where did you get the image from?
It's actually just
it's obviously
my,
not you.
No. My designer found it, and so she sourced it for me.
What I thought was interesting about there's a couple of things, Chrissy, that I found interesting in this is your foreword. You didn't pull any punches. You actually. Put your heart on the line here, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I have been known for my honesty. That's true.
You know, this... can I read this out?
Sure.
When I should have been old enough to know better, I dreamed that a penis was long and pink like the soft, wormy erection of our family dog. When I first held one, it surprised me with its width and firmness. When I first saw one, I was intrigued and mystified with a kind of childlike wonder. I still experience that kind of play when I'm naked and alone with my lover. That, I think, is extraordinarily honest.
Oh, and these things mark you. You do remember these things in life. So.
Just extraordinary. And what I think is fascinating about it from a man's point of view is, mm-hmm. of course it's not. But if I think back when I was preteen and I go, ooh. What are they like, you know? And I was fascinated by girls and women. And I remember bailing up my mother in the bathroom, and I so desperately wanted her to, you know, I just wanted, just show me this thing which I don't understand. You know? So that's what we all are like.
That's right. And a household full of women, growing up in a household just completely full of women.
Well,
and no men anywhere inside, and no men allowed to be inside. I had absolutely no concept, and with no access to anything that would describe a man physically, like no access to pornography or writing about sexuality or any sort of how-to manuals that kids might have. So I had absolutely no idea.
What was your sex education like? Was it not there?
No, none.
So it was the schoolyard of sex education?
Yeah. That's right. I didn't know where babies came from. I had no idea.
What was your reaction when you found out the mechanical process of it all?
Well, I only found out because everyone was laughing at a joke at school, and I should have known the punchline of the joke, but I didn't because I didn't understand that that mummies and daddies had to be in bed together. And so because I hadn't grown up with a mother and a father in the sort of stereotypically traditional way, I just expected that they hadn't spent any time in bed together, and so said that quite blindly and got laughed at, and then kind of had to go around, you know, whispering and asking why people were laughing at that. So this was probably in grade 5 or 6.
Okay, so you're still just a kid.
Still just a kid, but at a stage where everybody else knew that, you know, it took a man and a woman to make a baby.
Right.
And I hadn't kind of twigged to that.
Right. Were you shocked when you found out the mechanics?
Do
what with what and put it where?
No, I wasn't shocked so much as intrigued.
Right.
I was very interested. And I also, I was very interested. I loved science experiments when I was a kid. And so...
Well, you reveal that further on. I mean, I won't read it, but further on in that forward, you actually describe coming across some erotica and the fascination of it. And so what did that lead to? Was that the start, the kindling for this fire?
Yeah, definitely. Anais Nin finding, being lent one of her books by a girlfriend from school was very important in that, you know, in my future. But I basically just wanted to experiment and try everything out. I wanted access to this world that I didn't know anything about. And it's still to this day... Being brought up without any exposure to that still shows to this day. I still make faux pas without realizing I'm making a faux pas, because to me all sexuality was of a level. There was no, you know, first base, second base, third base. Yeah. It was just all, you know, kissing was equally as banned as you know, having sex or right. oral sex, and I had no way of knowing that some people find things less acceptable socially.
So do you get it now?
Not really, because it's a little bit from okay, talking to people.
Do you get it intellectually?
Sort of.
Do you get it emotionally?
I get surprised by women, because I do occasionally come across women who find some things, you know, they just assume that you'd never do that and it would be, you know, out of bounds. And for me, there is no out of bounds, you know, unless it's non-consensual, which is something I understand.
But do you understand that emotionally, or have you had to understand that intellectually?
I understand that in every way. I understand that consensual sex is the only
right.
sex that should be there. But I also understand that fantasies about non-consensual sex are any sort of fantasy about sexuality should be allowed, regardless of what taboo it breaks, I think. But actually participating in it, it has to be, you know, not hurting someone.
Yeah, we live in a real
bottom,
world.
Yeah, yeah, that's the bottom line, is that you can't hurt someone.
Yeah, do no harm.
Or you can try not to hurt someone. I understand that you do hurt people without meaning to, but it's trying not to hurt people. And within the bounds of that, for me, everything is okay. And I still get surprised when some people will, you know, balk at something that I find...
So,
completely normal behaviour.
So is that why, you know, because I've read a fair bit of erotica,
mm.
you know, I've actually developed, not that long ago, probably only about 10 years ago, a fascination for female-written erotica.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually did it very consciously to try and get in the head of women.
Mm.
I wanted to understand where women were coming from. I sort of got the male erotic when I read that. I went, oh, yeah, fair enough, got that, you know, two chicks, you know,
mm-hmm.
fine.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started reading female erotica, I discovered this world that was very different to what I expected. Mm. But everything I read was pretty well what we know as normal sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
half a dozen different activities.
Mm-hmm.
Then I picked this little thing up, and I sort of go, what the hell is this?
You know, like, yeah, it's a bit odd.
So when you have... You know, we've got normal activity, you know, first base, second base, you know, a bit of oral sex, intercourse, that's what's seen as standard practice.
Yep. Yep.
Do you see that, because of your upbringing,
yeah.
the way you were brought up, do you see that as being absolutely the same, emotionally or whatever, intellectually in your world, as some of the stories you've written here?
Yeah, I do. Actually, for me personally, I didn't kind of enter the sexual world with those kind of boundaries. And so for me, it was about... just experience everything you can and experiment with everything that you possibly can, because it was all just one big playground.
And I think that's why you're probably able to write about it, because, like, I'm going to mention it, it's the most mm-hmm. fascinating one of the three stories,
mm-hmm.
is I would never imagined how conjoined twins would have had sex.
Mm. Thing you think about when you think about conjoined twins,
no,
for me.
No, I didn't. I just thought about the fact that you can't get away from somebody.
I think having sex and going to the toilet are the first things I think about when I think about people like that.
But you thought about that because you thought about sexuality, I get the feeling, just like you would think about sexuality with anybody.
Yeah.
In any situation, so why not them as well?
Yeah.
And then you wrote this story about... you know, these, you know, two twins lying in bed
mm-hmm.
with one set of genitals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, the realisation for me was, of course, it must be like that.
Yeah.
But I'd never thought it through.
I do think about, that's something that comes to me all the time. I'm constantly thinking about how people have sex. I'm constantly...
What's more valuable, because that's your world, you live in your little head there, living, and everybody does, has a variation. I'm sure if many people listen to this, they'll go, hey Ian, come on, yeah I think that too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think of a lot of stuff, but you wrote it down, and I think that's what's interesting. You actually went to the trouble of writing a piece and putting it out there. Sure, you can go on the web and you can find all sorts of weird stuff going on, you know.
Yeah.
But this is different. This is literature. This is a book. This is, this is wild.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. That's the plan. I mean, you know, I'm if I'm fascinated by something, and that's the other thing too, is that because my my early experience of sexuality when I finally sort of left home and was released into the world was quite hedonistic, and because I did pack a lot of experience into a very short period of time, I got to the point where I had to imagine more to be aroused by it, that things that you know, if you become a foodie and you eat everything, you want to eat something that, you know, that nobody else has eaten. You want to kind of, you know, experience that.
Gastronaut.
And
rottenaut.
That's right, rottenaut, absolutely. And because I'd settled down in my sexual life, because I met my partner and have been with him for a very long period of time, and in a, you know, in a very monogamous heterosexual relationship for that period of time, it then had to become a world of fantasy because,
right,
you know, my sexual exploration wasn't over. There is so much more to learn.
Yeah, well, if you're going to put those restrictions, if you want to call them that, you know, homosexual monogamous, you know, you can't go and play in these other worlds.
That's right, so you have to imagine them. And that was that's where it comes from, I suppose. It's from, you know, now being within the confines of my life.
Okay, so, you know, and cut me short if I get too personal. You live this hedonistic life, as you said, and now you're in this relationship with these restrictions on it that don't allow you to go back there. Why put the restrictions on yourself? Why not have an open relationship? Why not have a, and you use the term vanilla, why not have a non-vanilla? Why not have a double dip chop chip relationship that allows the hedonistic aspects to still percolate through?
Because a relationship is about two people, I think, and because it had to be something that we, it had to be a relationship that we both agreed on. Also, because
it wasn't possible to agree on a.
No, I don't think. I don't think in this particular situation it was. And I have had relationships where that was the norm, where you know, it was, you know, a free for all, anything goes kind of a relationship. But I also found that within those relationships, the dynamics become very tricky to negotiate long term, because you're. You know, there are so many other people involved in that relationship that it's a constant negotiation process about what are the rules and when are you hurting someone and when are you not. And, you know, it just becomes kind of tedious. It becomes, you know, like managing a committee or something.
Yeah.
And so even though the sexual experiences within those relationships were fantastic and wonderful and I enjoyed them and have great memories, I also remember, you know, almost being on a management committee at times where you're kind of going, you know, I have to negotiate with all these people.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to my sexual partners, and there's five
really
of you around
annoying.
The table.
Yeah, and it just becomes, you know, like living in a community or something, which, you know, is all well and fine in theory, but then when you do it, it becomes, you know, this process of constant having to negotiate.
So was it just too exhausting? It was just easier to go...
It's just hard, yeah, it's hard. And also I that was a kind of parameters that my partner put out there as well, that's what he wanted for a relationship.
Right.
And I'm very glad, you know, that even at first I kind of went, oh, I'm not sure I can do that. But I'm actually really glad that I did, because that has given me the stability to be able to build a life where I can have my writing and the other things without having to put that much energy into my personal life.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I can put energy into my personal life, but it's not the sort of energy, the exhausting energy that it comes with negotiating with a committee.
So do you think you would have explored a book like this if you had have maintained the old relationships? Or do you think, you know?
Yeah, I always had one eye, even while I was in those relationships, I always had one thing in the back of my head saying, oh, this is research. Even back then, I remember being in the middle of things and going, this is going to be great research for later.
I can only wonder in future writings as you read it, you go, well, did she actually get involved in this little bit, or is this bit fantasy? Which is real? Which
I'm
is...
so waiting for people to come out of the closet and go, sprung, but no one has yet, so it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Brisbane's a small place, no doubt there will be people emerging going, I remember when. And, you know, I just figure I'll admit to everything, whatever.
Well, either you deny everything or admit to everything.
Yeah, I'm just as long as you keep everything, yeah. Even if it's not true, I'll go, oh yeah, I probably did that. But that's the other thing too, is that I don't necessarily remember every situation. Yeah. So you know, it probably.
Oh yeah, that's right. And if you've had a lot of fantasies, the fantasies may have become your realities too.
Yeah, and I was very vague and. You know, as you are when you're a kid.
Yeah, sex and drugs and rock and roll.
That's right.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
So where to from now?
More writing. I've got always working on a novel. I've got several that I have written that I think are finished, but I've got one that I've just pulled apart again, even though I thought it was finished, and I'm rewriting that at the moment. I want to get something published through a regular publisher, a novel. Eat Books has got a slate of small books that we're going to publish next year by other authors, which is really exciting. So there's the publishing line, but also for my own work, I'm still chasing the perfect book. I want to write something that when I finish it, I look at it and go, this is going to last 100 years, you know, people from 100 years from now are going to read this. I really want to do that, and I have nothing I've written.
This is your stamp of immortality, is it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I want to write something that's going to, you know, I read.
Do you want to change the world with it?
I don't want to change the world, but I certainly want it to be a solid kind of pillar of writing. I look at Steinbeck. I read Of Mice and Men recently. It's a little slim book, and you read it and you go, that's perfect. You know, that is perfect.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a War and Peace, does it?
Oh, it doesn't. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. And that in itself is a perfect piece of work. And if I'd written that, I would be able to go, oh, well, that's it. I've written that book.
Lie down and die.
Lie down and die. That's the book. But I haven't written anything like Of Mice and Men yet. And when I do, then I can relax. Because then I'll go, I've achieved what I wanted to do.
Well, we'll see, eh? Mm. We'll see. Mm. Okay.
All right.
Well, that's who you are.
Yes.
Thank you, Chrissy. Now, I'll make sure I put links up. So give me all your links, and I'll make sure that they all go on the blog.
Okay.
And if anybody's interested, they can get hold of you, eh?
Great.
Okay.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And all the links are on the website. So come on over to yourstorypodcast.com. And there'll be also links there for the PodSafe audio music I used in amongst it all. And there's feeds and links across to iTunes if you want to sign up for the subscriptions, which, of course, are free. Everybody knows that, don't you? If you feel inspired, you can leave a message for me under the episode. There's also an email link. It's chat@yourstorypodcast.com. And I'd love to know that you're out there, people. So if you're out there and you're listening and you want to send me an email or post something, it'd be great. All the best. Until next time. Bye.
There are 8 million stories in the naked city. This has been one of them.